welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May 31st, 2009. Our guest today is going to be someone who's been a guest in the past, and we've always enjoyed having him. It's a great privilege and honor. We'll be joined by Noam Chomsky live on the telephone today for the full hour, so it should be a wonderful program. Before we go to Professor Chomsky and talk about the events of the day, let's go first to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
But what we talked about earlier was really about the government's role in ensuring open access, choice.
Communities itself, rather than just what's going on in NPR and what's coming out of Washington or something like that, and giving, you know, whole programs over and developing news kind of programs.
More than 500 media activists, journalists, tech entrepreneurs, industry executives, media policymakers, business owners, and content producers took their seats at the table at Washington's Newseum on May 14th to discuss the future of journalism, the importance of public media, and the urgent need for high-speed broadband access throughout the United States.
Big wallets and big houses.
And so also, so people realize, well, you know, what is our whole community? And I think when people realize...
The goal of the Free Press Summit, Changing Media, was to get stakeholders for all three issues together to find common goals and themes in their work. In today's turbulent media landscape, with new technologies changing the way information is distributed, issues of content production and infrastructure need to be better understood and linked. Summit organizer Misty Perez-Trudson explains.
We put together a rather elaborate seating plan to make sure that our tables kind of filled equally and that everybody who came, whether they came with a group of their colleagues or friends or allies, weren't sitting at the same table. It was important for us to really break people up and to have them sit with folks that they maybe haven't worked with before or didn't come in with in order to foster some rich cross-sector discussions.
The main thing is that people want to interact more, not less.
Joycelyn Tate of the Minority Media and Telecommunications Council appreciated the wide-ranging interests of her table.
It may have broadened some perspectives. Maybe some people that have been thinking only in terms of one particular issue, it's kind of broadened their perspective to see how all these things may be interrelated. So I think that was great.
Although he comes from a journalism perspective, Sam Greenberg of WHUS-FM in Storrs, Connecticut, said that the summit discussions showed how interconnected the issues are.
The way that everything's kind of connected nowadays, the interactivity of everything was on display today. Especially with journalism, you see that one thing affects another thing, and I think it's definitely important that we look at all three things when you're actually talking about this issue.
Dave Hazeltine is a student at the University of Connecticut.
The discussion was lively, and it was really interesting to meet new people and the interactive electronic voting process and all that, and to actually have a policy discussion that you can see take place visually in a graphic representation was very cool.
Emily Schwartz-Greco of the Institute for Policy Studies agreed.
Because there was such a large range of issues on the table, we had, therefore, a wide range of people to discuss the issues. And I think having all those different perspectives helped us reach really interesting conclusions.
Inez Gonzalez of the National Hispanic Media Coalition.
I thought it was really interesting. I wish that the group was more diverse. I mean, I'm a Latina, so there was predominantly a white group. So I think that's why it's really important that we have the community-based organizations also on board.
Perez Trudson says that facilitated discussions are a good step in the direction of getting underrepresented groups to take their place at the table and getting heard in the highest levels of policymaking.
You have to really invest a lot of energy and you have to be committed to making it work. And if you want it to work for the life of a campaign or an issue or for our lives in general, it's that you can't leave populations out and you have to always consider who's at the table, who's in the planning process, who's in the recruitment process and what's happening afterwards.
Inez Gonzalez wants to make sure there are media policies in place that have accountability and serve various communities.
It's a very unique opportunity that we have to make a difference and that we have to move quickly but united, and that people should be able to get the Congress attention and the FCC attention on how we can get broadband for everyone.
Free Press will be releasing a report on the results of the discussions later this summer. To watch or listen to the speeches and panel or read transcripts of the Free Press Summit, go to freepress.net/summit.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, coming to you live May 31st, 2009, here in WILL AM 580. Today's guest is an old and dear friend and also someone who's very modest, so I will not pour on the accolades as I introduce him. Let me just say that he is a linguist and a writer on politics and media, and someone who many of our listeners have frequently said they like to have on the program, and I'm delighted to welcome him today. Noam Chomsky, welcome to Media Matters.
Yeah, be glad to be with you again.
You know, there's a lot of ground to cover since we last spoke, and I think the first place I'd like to start, and I think an area you've been writing about for now decades, is the Israel and Palestine, and especially what's going on in Gaza, and your sense of how, if at all, the politics of the area are changing.
Well, there's a good deal of excitement in the air about that. There's the Obama-Netanyahu-Abbas meetings last week are generally described as a turning point in U.S. Middle East policy. So, for example, the Middle East commentator, analyst of the Washington Post, Dan Frumkin, sees what he calls signs that, actually I'm quoting him, Obama will promote a new regional peace initiative, much like the one championed by Jordan's King Abdullah, and he's about to play hardball with Israel. That's a pretty common view. Unfortunately, there are no signs of it. Abdullah has a position, and he's made it very clear. Namely, there will be no change in the Arab peace initiative, no amendment of it. Any talk about amending of it is baseless. President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, actually ex-president, his term ran out several months ago, Abbas agrees completely, no change. Well, what's that Arab peace initiative? The Arab peace initiative essentially reiterates a very broad international consensus that the U.S. and Israel have been unilaterally blocking for over 30 years and still do. It calls for a two-state settlement on the internationally recognized border with guarantees of the right of every state to peace and security and so on and so forth, perhaps with minor and mutual modifications in the border. That's official U.S. wording from 1967 to 1971 before the United States departed from world opinion on this issue and has remained aside. So the Arab Peace Initiative reiterates that call. Abdullah goes beyond, and then it calls for, in that context, after a two-state settlement is established on the international border, the Arab states should proceed to normalize relations with Israel. And Abdullah's addition, as he says, all 57 Arab and Islamic states should do so. Well, there isn't even a hint that the U.S. is willing to accept this. I mean, President Obama has discussed it. In fact, he called it a very constructive proposal. He mentioned it as the one constructive proposal on the table in his one declaration about the topic. But then he proceeded to say that the Arab states should implement this proposal by normalizing relations with Israel. Well, he knows perfectly well that's not what the initiative was. It called for a two-state settlement, and in that context, proceeding to normalize relations, he very scrupulously left out the core of the proposal, which can only mean that he intends to continue to reject it. Now, the same was true in the what's been, in fact, so far the most important formulation of Obama administration thinking on this topic. That's an important speech by, which was unfortunately not reported, as far as I know, by Senator John Kerry. He's the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He gave a speech at the Brookings Institute where he says we have to reconceptualize the whole issue. We've failed to find a legitimate partner for Israel after all these years. But at last, he said, the Arab states are overcoming their intransigence. They have now put forth the Arab Peace Initiative, which is in fact barely distinct from what they brought to the Security Council in 1976 and the U.S. vetoed and has continued to. But now they've put it forth. We find it constructive, and they must proceed to normalize relations with Israel. He also says there's now a legitimate Palestinian partner for the first time. And it's quite interesting how he says this. He says that in the West Bank, the security forces that the U.S. has trained, along with its allies, the Jordanian and the Egyptian dictatorships, those are what are called moderates in the U.S. The U.S. has trained security forces. They're run in conjunction with Israel by a U.S. general, General Keith Dayton. And Kerry is specifically impressed by the fact that during the Israeli attack on Gaza, when there was concern that there would be protests in the West Bank, the security forces were able to contain them. So there was no visible protest in the West Bank when fellow Palestinians were being slaughtered in Gaza. So maybe there's now a legitimate partner for peace under a proxy military force and in some kind of a what may be called someday a Palestinian state, but in a form that is determined by the daily ongoing programs which the U.S. continues to support. The alleged confrontation between the U.S. and Israel actually turns on two words, two phrases. One of them is the phrase Palestinian state. The other is the phrase natural growth. So Obama has pronounced the words Palestinian state. In fact, he's reiterated what Bush said about that. Bush added to what's called his vision acceptance of Israeli expansion in accord with the program that it's been implementing, taking over it's what Prime Minister Olmert, preceding Prime Minister, called convergence. Israel takes over the territory within the separation wall that's good part of the arable land, and crucially it's the water source for the region, the West Bank aquifer, which means that Israel can continue to ensure that almost all the water goes to Israelis, not to Palestinians. Recent World Bank report estimated that Israelis get about four times what Palestinians do of the West Bank aquifer. So that'll continue. It includes Greater Jerusalem, very substantial sector of the West Bank, where extensive construction is going on right now, displacing Arabs. That would separate Jerusalem, Greater Jerusalem, from any part of the West Bank left to the Palestinians. It's traditionally the core of cultural, political, social, educational life. And in the rest of the West Bank, Israel will take over the Jordan Valley. That imprisons what's left. Again, arable land and about a third of the West Bank. And then there are salients driven right through it, essentially breaking it up into cantons. And not a word is being said about that. In fact, As far as anyone knows, that's what Obama means by a Palestinian state, whatever's left, just what Bush meant. He's been very scrupulous not to say anything more. He did ignore, essentially reject the Arab Peace Initiative, as Kerry did, in the manner that I described.
Professor Chomsky, let me reintroduce you to our audience, if I may. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today. Our guest, Professor Noam Chomsky, talking to us on the telephone from his home in Massachusetts. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Chomsky, the telephone number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We've been talking about the Israeli-Palestine situation for the first 10 minutes or so of the program. And Professor Chomsky, if I can, you know, I asked if there was any reason for optimism, and I sense from your answer, in the sense that the term has been used, there isn't a great deal of reason. If the sense is based on U.S. government change in fundamental policy, what happens if the United States and Israeli policies remain as they are at present, indefinitely into the future? How long can this? Where does this take us?
There's no reason why it can't be indefinite. I mean, it's very commonly argued, you hear this all the time, that either Israel will accept an authentic two-state settlement in accord with the international consensus, Arab Peace Initiative, or else it'll be an apartheid state ruling over a Palestinian population of roughly the same size as the Jewish population, and then there could be an anti-apartheid struggle, as in the case of South Africa. But those are not the two alternatives. There's a third alternative, exactly what is being done, namely continue with the what's called the convergence program, which I've just outlined, which keeps annex it in some form or other, maybe officially or in some other way, into Israel. That leaves Israel essentially pretty much free of Arabs. It can become even more so under plans that are now being proposed. They were considered ultra-right when they were first proposed by Avigdor Lieberman, but they've moved to the center. They've even been endorsed by the New York Times. That's a plan to take the parts of Israel that have Israel itself, that have a heavy Arab concentration. The specific area in question is what's called Wadi Ara. It's right near the international border in the Galilee, heavy Arab population concentration, and just forcefully transfer it over into this derisory thing called Palestine. Of course, depriving the essentially moving Israeli citizens from a rich first world country into a barely surviving third world quasi country. Of course, they passionately oppose it and vehemently, but that's not considered. Ethan Bronner, the New York Times correspondent, recently described this as a policy that's very welcome to the left because it yields Israeli land to the Palestinians. He didn't bother to mention that what it yields is Israeli land of where Palestinian citizens live, and they don't want to. But that's another plan that's in the offing, and it probably will come about.
No, and this sounds to me like when a corporation is having all sorts of economic problems and it splits into two corporations, and one corporation's given all the valuable assets, and the other corporation's given all the debt.
Right, exactly. That's essentially what's happening to the financial system.
Well, if we can, Noam Chomsky, I'd like to go to the phone line right now. We have two callers patiently waiting. If anyone else would like to join them, the number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Again, our guest on Media Matters, Professor Noam Chomsky, speaking to us live today from Massachusetts. Feel free to call in. Now let's go first, if we can, to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Professor Chomsky.
Hi, good afternoon. I appreciate very much an interview I heard when you were confronted with this two-state, one-state solution, that you really prefer a no-state solution, but that you thought a two-state solution would be necessary to go through in some fashion if there was an honest broker, I guess. I recall that Bush used to talk about contiguity, and I think they started not saying that to describe a Palestinian state, and I don't think I've ever heard anybody in the Obama administration refer to contiguity or viability or anything like that, so I regret that I share your pessimism. One thing I'd like for you to sort of line out is the commonplace here in our discourse is that Hamas did a coup against Fatah after winning an election, but they threw the Fatah out. But the analysis I saw was that Elliot Abrams in the White House and his minions were actually arming Fatah to take out Hamas violently in a sort of a U.S.-sponsored civil war. So I wanted you to sort of confirm that and talk about your analysis of that. And if I might, I would like for you to change. I'm sure you want to get to say something about Afghanistan. And I was quite impressed by the your citation of a poll that showed when Afghans were asked with broad scope what political figure they favored the most or preferred. I don't know, maybe you can cite the language. That was Najibullah, who was violently killed. He was the communist last leader under the communist government, and it's a really striking thing. I was in conversation with an Egyptian and a Pakistani and I believe a Maghrebi guy, and they were all just sort of befuddled by it and were suspicious of the poll. So I wanted you to there, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, caller. Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, on both points, you're essentially correct. It's the fact a little bit different. In Gaza, Hamas, there was a free election in January 2006, so probably the major free election in the Arab world. The U.S. didn't like the way it turned out, so the wrong people won. So the U.S. and Israel instantly turned to severe punishment of the population for having dared to vote the wrong way in a free election. And it was really tough, extremely harsh. And meanwhile, as you said, the United States and Israel were planning a military coup. It was to be led by Mohammad Dahlan. He's a kind of a very brutal Fatah strongman who's in Gaza. And they were arming and training forces to carry out a military coup to overthrow the government. Well, Hamas preempted it. That's the June 2007 coup that's described here. The way it's described here is that Hamas just, overthrew the legitimate government or something. What they in fact did, and it's been well documented, there's no real dispute about it, is preempt a military coup that was intended to overthrow the government. And then, of course, U.S.-Israeli attack extended severely after that. Afghanistan, it wasn't actually a poll. It was a report by Sir Cedric Braithwaite. He was the former chair of the British Joint Intelligence Committee, or whatever its name is, a specialist on Afghanistan. He was, in fact, a British ambassador to Afghanistan. He was British ambassador to Pakistan in 1988 to 1992, roughly. That's the period when the Russians withdrew and went into the transition with the U.S.-backed radical Islamist forces tearing the place to shreds. And Najibullah was the president at the time. He recently took a tour in Afghanistan. He traveled around, spoke to lots of leaders and, activists, other groups, and he came back and produced a report in which he said that, to his surprise, the most when people were asked who's their favorite past leader, present, or who would be their choice, they did prefer Najibullah, and he said that's kept evident in the streets, pictures of him and so on. He was the last political leader imposed by the Russians before they withdrew, and he stayed on for a couple of years afterwards. He was then Kabul was the capital almost torn to shreds by the forces that the U.S. had been backing, and they captured him and killed him viciously. I think he was later killed by the Taliban. The Taliban came in, and they were actually welcomed because the situation was so horrendous when the radical Islamist forces that the U.S. had organized took over. But yeah, that's the story on Najibullah. There wasn't any poll. It was just Braithwaite's report after his inquiry, and he's pretty well placed to draw conclusions. He's a leading specialist in rich intelligence.
Noam Chomsky, the caller, also alluded briefly to the idea that you would prefer a no-state solution, which I think was a reference to your political views and political philosophy more broadly.
More than that, I mean, you know, if you look back in the history, the period of probably greatest freedom in the whole region in recent period was under the Ottoman Empire. I mean, nobody wants to restore the Ottoman Empire with its brutality and corruption, but it had some good parts. One aspect of it is it basically left people alone. So you could go from, I mean, the Greeks would run their area of some city, the Armenians would run another area, and so on, and they lived kind of in cooperation and peace and relative autonomy. I mean, of course, there's a harsh Ottoman rule on top of it, but it wasn't very much present. You could also travel from Cairo to Istanbul to Baghdad without crossing a border or, you know, needing a visa, anything like that. Well, you know, that kind of an arrangement is not at all inappropriate to that region. In fact, to much of the world, in my opinion.
That actually gets to the point I wanted to get to, Professor Chomsky, which is recently there was a poll in the United States, and I can't recall who did it, and I can't recall the exact figures, but it asked Americans if they'd prefer capitalism or socialism.
Mm-hmm.
You might have seen it.
And, yes, it did.
And surprisingly, a very significant percentage of Americans, not a majority, but still significant, especially young Americans, said they would prefer socialism. And this is after decades of, I think it's fair to say, getting nothing but bad press in the United States as a topic and being dismissed as ridiculous.
There are interesting poll results on this topic. For example, in one of the most interesting was in 1976, you know, 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, there was a poll, extensive poll, asking people, giving people phrases and asking them whether they thought those phrases were in the Constitution. Well, you know, not many people know what's in the Constitution. So what they were basically answering is, do you think this phrase is a sufficiently obvious truth so it must be in the Constitution? One of the phrases that got a majority support was, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Straight out of the Communist Manifesto.
Yeah, from the Communist Manifesto. Well, you know, what I was wondering when I heard that, and I'm just interested in your thoughts, because you came of age in the late 1930s and 1940s in an era in which left politics and socialist politics worldwide were pronounced, but in the United States played a much more significant role than they have since then. And given the world economic crisis, do you think that we might be at a moment where the concerns, the great concerns of socialists, are going to return to the front burner?
Well, we have to be a little careful about that, because the term socialism, like the term capitalism, has been almost completely deprived of meaning. So we don't even know what it refers to anymore. I mean, the doctrinal systems have constructed an image of socialism, which means Soviet tyranny. That had nothing to do with socialism. In fact, in my view, the Bolshevik Revolution was one of the major attacks on socialism in the 20th century, and the collapse of the Soviet Union was a small victory for socialism. Traditionally, what socialism meant is control by producers over production, and control of workers' self-management, and control of all other institutions, community, whatever, democratically by the population. That's socialism. The Soviet Union was farther from that than the United States was. Socialism does not mean state control. That's what it's been turned into. In fact, the socialist movement was broken up into several components, and the part that's always attracted me, which is called in Europe and traditionally libertarian socialism, was the anti-state component of socialism. No contradiction there. So the traditional term is very different from the current doctrinal meaning. But is there, and the traditional notion, I think, is right at the border of possible activism today. So take, for example, let's take the closing of GM, okay, and, you know, virtual closing of GM and Chrysler. You know, that's a fantastic indictment of the socioeconomic system we live in. I mean, here, there are major manufacturing institutions, plenty of skilled workers, you know, machines and so on, a tradition, communities. They're being essentially, you know, eliminated while the country desperately needs what they can produce. In fact, in the Wall Street Journal two or three days ago, there was an article about how excited the Spanish and the French and the Germans are because of Obama's the parts of the stimulus, new stimulus, which are going to go to high-speed rail. And so, for example, the Spanish think, well, okay, we can provide high-speed rail systems that the U.S. is incapable of producing. Is the U.S. incapable of producing them? Well, thanks to the way our economic system works, yes. What we do is destroy, get rid of the institutions and kick the manufacturing firms and kick out the workforce, and then buy it from Spain. I mean, GM and Chrysler could perfectly well produce that, in fact, better. What ought to be done if in a rational society is, if the GM and Chrysler management are so totally incompetent that they destroyed the corporation, the industries, which in fact they did, thanks to total incompetence, it simply should be taken over by the workforce and the communities, and they should convert it to a production of exactly what's needed, you know, green technology, high-speed rail systems, and so on. You know, that would be the rational way to proceed, and that would be authentic socialism. But that's not what's talked about. Actually, it's come pretty close a few times. So a few months ago, there was a factory, Republic Windows and Doors or some such name in Chicago, mm-hmm. which was closed. The corporation that owned it, it was going to close it down. They couldn't get a loan from Bank of America. And the workers sat in. Well, you know, a sit-in is one step before taking over the factory. Now, that's why back in the 1930s, elite groups, manufacturers and others, became so terrified when sit-ins started. That's when the real New Deal programs were pushed through. Sit-ins are dangerous. They're a step towards real democracy, takeover of the production by people who produce workers and communities. And that happened at Republic. The company backed down, in fact, and sold it off, and I think most of the workers still have their jobs. They sold it off to some green technology institution in California. Well, you know, that kind of thing, and it's happening right now in England, the United Kingdom, in Belfast and elsewhere. It's right on the border, and it's the natural thing to do. Of course, it's not being considered here, like, you know, nobody in the government can even dream of it, but it should be in the minds of people. There's other times when it's come close here, too, and there are important cases, like about 30 years ago in Youngstown, Ohio, where there's a huge United Steel installation. It's basically a steel town from way back. U.S. Steel was going to close it down, and there were protests, sit-ins, and so on, and there was an effort in which Staunton Lind, a radical activist who's now a lawyer, it was a leading role. And they brought it actually to the courts and argued a case which made a good deal of sense, that if the company doesn't want to run it, they should give it over to the stakeholders. Stakeholders mean the workers in the community. And they should take it over, and they should run it. Now, maybe, you know, Bank of America wouldn't make a profit, but, you know, could easily make a profit, that sufficient profit to keep the community and the corporation going. Well, they lost in the courts, but that's an ideological judgment. I mean, there's nothing in economic theory or even in corporate law that says that stakeholders can't run a corporation.
Our guest, Noam Chomsky. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Phone lines open at 333-9455. Also, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller who's been waiting very patiently, and I hope she or he is still with us. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes. It's a great honor to talk to you, Dr. Chomsky. And also, I'm amazed at your energy, and I hope you're with us for a long time to come. I just wanted to ask about something that has really been bothering me increasingly recently, and I think a lot of other people as well. We thought we were getting something when we voted for Obama, a progressive on a variety of fronts. And if you look even at his approach to Iran, there was a recent New York Times op-ed column by a couple of Middle East policy experts who were noting that, of course, he's continuing a lot of the policies that Bush took toward the Iranians, including covert operations to destabilize Iran. And when you combine that with actions like the preventive detention as a policy to deal with quote-unquote terrorists from now on, some of us are very, very upset about this, including me, because I can't see into Obama's soul, as it were. Is he simply, what is his agenda in doing these things? And with regard to Iran itself, of course, I'm interested, but also, what's your sense of what is he simply another Clinton in a sense, a sort of gutless politician who sort of?
My view all along has been that he's essentially a pretty familiar centrist Democrat. Mm. Actually, there's a detailed study of his political background, you know, before running for president and on, by Paul Street, his Chicago-based political analyst, and I think it's basically accurate that Joe was writing about it before the election. And he never really indicated anything different. I mean, if you look back at the campaign, he kind of presented himself as a sort of a blank slate. Let's have change. Everybody hates the way the country's going, so let's have change. And let's have hope. And let's be inspired. And let's look to the future, forget about the past, and so on. You can write on that slate anything you like. But there was no real basis for expecting very much. I mean, there were some campaign proposals about, you know, health and so on, but not in a form that anybody could take seriously. That's normal in campaigns. In fact, as you probably know, the advertising industry gives an award every year to the best advertising campaign of the year, the advertising age. And for 2008, they gave it to Obama. Said they ran the best advertising campaign of the year, beating out Apple Computer. In fact, the business executives exulted. They said, we've been marketing candidates like commodities ever since Reagan, and this is the best we've ever done. It's going to change the the mood in corporate boardrooms. We'll have to have a different style and so on. I think that's more or less accurate. So you really can't accuse him of misleading people, or maybe misleading, but not a deception, because he didn't say very much. And you're right. I think the column you were quoting was probably the Leverett's, Flynn Hillary Leverett. And they went through the Obama proposals, and what they said, I think, is accurate. They said it's the Bush proposals prettified. That was, I think, the word they used. The rhetoric is nicer, makes people feel better. It's very welcome abroad. So in Europe, for example, and even in the Middle East, you know, people much prefer the Obama style. I mean, the Bush style, especially his first term, was simply brazen arrogance and contempt. You do what we say or you're irrelevant. We kick you in the face. And, you know, European leaders don't like to hear that. What they'd like to hear is, you're our friend, you're our partner, we love you, and then we'll kick you in the face quietly. Actually, there's a nice characterization of that that comes out of the Kennedy administration. Right at the peak of the missile, from the internal record, it's been declassified for a couple of years, at the peak of the missile crisis, when, you know, there was a real threat, that there was a serious threat of nuclear war, which they could have wiped out Europe. The U.S. would have been secure, but it would have wiped out Europe, and they were upset about it. The British, particularly, they're supposed to have a special relationship, but the Kennedy administration leaders wouldn't tell the British what was going on. So the prime minister only knew what British intelligence could pick up. At right at that time, a senior Kennedy advisor, I think it was Dean Acheson probably, defined what he called the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain. His words were, the British are our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner. Okay, they like to hear the fashionable word. And that's essentially the difference between Obama and Bush, as far as I can see. Bush, you know, Rumsfeld and the rest of them were just arrogant thugs. They went and said, you're our lieutenant. If you don't like it, it's too bad. Obama goes over and says, you're our partner. We love you. We're listening to you. Then he goes home and does whatever he likes. You know? And they accept that.
Noam Chomsky, is the world changing such that the U.S. ability to dictate to the world is not as powerful as it once was? And are we in the midst of seeing the U.S. role fundamentally change from what it has been for the last 50 or 100 years?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one dramatic example of it is coming up right now. It has to do with Cuba and the Organization of American States. I mean, in the past, the United States was successful, you know, from Kennedy on, in basically compelling the Organization of American States to isolate Cuba. Now the tables are turned. The organization is isolating the United States in its refusal to permit Cuba, you know, to enter back in if it wants to. And that's a very striking change. And it reflects a shift in the nature of power. Actually, that shift will be illustrated again, I think next September, when G20 meets in Pittsburgh. Now it's G20, you know, the 20 major economies. Not long ago, it was G7, and in fact, it was more often G3, and in reality, G1, the United States. Everyone else did what the U.S. wanted. Okay, now they have to have G20. I mean, it's still, the U.S. plays a preponderant role. It's far and away the most, you know, the single major economy in the world. I mean, the EU is comparable, but, you know, it's a lot of countries. And in military power, the United States is simply preeminent. It spends more than the rest of the world combined, probably as much as the rest of the world combined, you know, much more advanced, hundreds of bases all over the world and so on. So it's still predominant, but in a much more diverse international system. Latin America, for the first time in 500 years, is kind of getting its act together, moving off towards some degree of integration and attention to its own massive internal problems. And integration's a prerequisite for independence, so it's kind of separating itself increasingly from U.S. domination. And these, what are called the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, are growing independent economies, in substantial ones, not on the scale of the U.S. or EU, but substantial. And they're developing relationships among themselves. So, for example, Brazil and China, Venezuela and China, Brazil and South Africa, and so on, all have relations. Which are growing and developing, and the U.S. just can't run things the way it used to. I mean, you can see it, for example, in military coups. I mean, if the U.S. didn't like a government in Latin America, It just initiated a military coup and overthrew it. It happens so often, there's no point running through them, especially the Kennedy-Johnson years and later. Well, you know, the last time it tried a military coup was in 2002, when the U.S. backed a military coup to overthrow the government of Venezuela. But that was beaten back in about 2 days. Extreme protests in Latin America, and internally overthrown, and the U.S. couldn't do much about it. In fact, the one successful coup was in Haiti. In 2004, Britain and France, the traditional torturers of Haiti, did overthrow the Aristide government and forced Aristide, elected president, to go to Africa. In fact, the U.S. won't let him back into the entire Caribbean. But, you know, Haiti's a very weak country, practically destroyed by French and U.S. colonialism. So there they were able to carry off a coup, but nothing since.
Professor Chomsky, what do you make of Venezuela specifically? The Chavez government is reviled in our news media and is a source of controversy on the political left as well. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to visit there, but I know you have been to Latin America and you know the region well. What is your assessment of what's going on there?
Well, you know, I think it's a mixed story. I think there are a lot of very positive things going on. On the other hand, there's a streak of caudillism, you know, kind of authoritarianism, which and there's a lot of corruption, which Chavez hasn't been able to rule out, hasn't been able to get rid of the criminality. It's under constant attack. I mean, the coup is one case, but there was an effort to really destroy the economy by the old elite, by essentially what amounted to a capital strike in the oil industry on which it's based. But they've pulled out of it. They've had a reasonable growth rate. And I think, you know, there are things to criticize. There are things to praise. But what really matters is, what do Venezuelans think about it? It doesn't matter what I think about it. And there are regular polls. Latino Barometros, a Chilean-based polling agency, which is highly respected and does annual studies of public opinion in Latin America. And ever since the Chavez years, Venezuela has been at or near the top, usually along with Uruguay, in popular support for democracy, support for the government, hope for the future, and so on. And I presume this is the reflection of things like the missions. I mean, a lot of the population believes, with some justice, that this is the first government that's really trying to do anything for the vast poor majority. So I think there's a basis for controversy. You know, you can ask questions about this or that program, but it's and internationally, it's had a pretty constructive role. It's playing a significant role in the integration of Latin America. The Bank of the South, which was just established, it's Petrocaribe, has been giving oil on concessionary terms, relatively inexpensive oil, to poor countries in Central and America and the Caribbean. It's been cooperating with Cuba and some really effective programs. There's one called Operation Miracle, which it brings people from, you know, countries like, say, Jamaica and others to the Cuban medical profession is very advanced. They go and find people who are blind but could be cured by advanced surgical techniques, take them to Cuba. Venezuela funds it, and they return home able to see. You know, that has a big effect, as you can imagine, and it's a very successful program. The U.S. and Mexico toyed with trying to duplicate it, but couldn't carry it off. And, you know, these things are all significant. I think there are also criticisms that can be made about authoritarian style and some of the actions and so on. But in many ways, I think it's one of the more hopeful places. The place that really is inspiring, in my opinion, is Bolivia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a major democratic revolution of a kind that almost never takes place. I mean, it's downplayed or vilified. ratified here, and the U.S. is trying to undermine it. But what happened is pretty exciting. And this is not Venezuela. It's the second poorest country in the hemisphere, you know, after Haiti. The indigenous population, which is the majority, and the most bitterly repressed population in the hemisphere, they became organized, carried out many important actions, like driving Bechtel and the World Bank out of the country when they tried to privatize water about 10 years ago, and on and on. They finally entered the political arena and elected a president from their own ranks, following programs of great significance that come out of the population, not from the elite. Things like, say, control over resources and cultural rights. It's a highly multicultural region, economic justice, and so on. Well, that really is unusual. It's hard to find a democratic society like that. Certainly, we're not like that, nor is Western Europe. But the U.S. has the old elites, of course, are bitterly oppose it. And they're mostly in the eastern provinces, which unfortunately happens to be where the main oil hydrocarbon resources are. The opposition, they're moving towards a kind of autonomy or maybe quasi-secession. It did lead to violence last fall. And interesting events took place. I think a couple dozen peasants were killed by these quasi-secessionist movements. There was a meeting of the Union of South American Republics, UNASUR. It's a newly formed organization of the South American Republics, part of the steps towards integration are going on. They had a meeting in Chile to deal with this. They came out with a strong condemnation of the quasi-secessionist movements, the old elites, and they had strong support for Morales, the elected president. Morales then responded to that, thanking them for their support and pointing out that pretty accurately that this is the first time in 500 years since the European invasions that Latin Americans have been taking their affairs into their own hands without the interference of external powers. And last century or two, that means mainly the U.S. That was really important. In fact, a mark of its importance is that it apparently wasn't reported in the United States.
Professor Chomsky, we only have about 6 minutes left, and there are two callers waiting. Let's try to get at least one of them in if we can. Let's go now to line 4, Chicago. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Professor Chomsky.
Thank you. When the last interviews with Buckminster Fuller, host Larry King asked him, what of the things you have envisioned, what would you like to see occur for humanity? And he said, I'd love to see the people be able to communicate. And certainly, you've been the epitome of the forefront of communicating all the things that you've done so wonderfully. In fact, this is a very conversation today. I've had to change my questions 3 or 4 times, depending on the inspiration and stimulus you've presented on your views all through the program. However, when you talk about a coup, in a way we have a silent coup occurring with our military-industrial complex having such a hold on everything that we're all about here in this country. I was wondering if you could embellish a little bit upon how severe you think it is and whether you think it's going to be some way dealing with it that we can produce a catharsis for change. And I'll just sort of let it go at that, if you can make some comments on it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Professor Chomsky?
Yeah, I'm not sure entirely correct, but what kind of a society should we be looking for? You can't really call the military-industrial complex a coup. It's, you know, it's been going on for 60 years and had roots before. But, we have a certain social and economic system. It has several major crises right now. The one that's getting most of the attention is the financial crisis, but there's a huge manufacturing crisis, which in many respects is more serious. The Obama administration is basically trying to patch it up and keep it the way it was. You know, it's not much change. But what could people do? You know, a lot of things. In fact, I talked about a couple of them before. So, for example, take, say, the manufacturing industries. There's no economic reason, pure, you know, no reason in economic theory or in the law or anything else, why they can't be directly revived by stakeholder management, worker and community takeover, and turning them to reconstructing the society in a livable way. Now, it's not just a matter of high-speed trains. American society is going to have to be reconstructed radically if it's going to survive because of the environmental crisis, which is no joke, and it's getting serious, and it's pretty imminent. And that means, you know, we have over the especially the past 60 years, social organizations have been developed which are very highly energy intensive and destructive to the environment, and which separate people from one another. That's the whole process of suburbanization of America and destruction of inner cities. Now, that didn't just happen. It wasn't a market system. It was a major social engineering project carried out by leading corporations with the cooperation of state power. Time to run through it all now, but if you look into it, that's what it was. And that has to be dealt with somehow. And the appropriate kind of manufacturing technology can contribute substantially to that, but it'll have to be under popular democratic control, which is a radical change in the country, but quite consistent with leading strains in American history. And it's kind of hard to remember now, or you know, to remind ourselves that if you go back to the mid-19th century, American working people took for granted that wage labor is not very different from slavery. In fact, Abraham Lincoln's position was that the only difference between wage labor and slavery is that wage labor is temporary, slavery is permanent. Well, that's a deep tradition. They didn't pick that up from European radicalism. It's an indigenous tradition. And my own view is it's not very far below the surface, and I think that has to be revitalized. Unions have to be reconstructed, but as worker-based institutions, not sweetheart contracts with employers. And manufacturing has to be reconstructed.
Noam Chomsky, we've only got about a minute and a half left, I think. So, you know, just to wrap up on this point, because it's so important, what is your sense politically of the climate today or the last few years and how it compares to the last generation? So, I mean, do you think we're in a moment of change or that change for the better specifically, and not by the elites, but of the bulk of the population of society, or is it still unclear?
I think it's very unclear, but it's always unclear. I mean, nobody predicted what was going to happen in the 30s. Nobody predicted the 60s. I mean, these are really matters of will and choice. People have to become, you have to do it. It doesn't happen by itself. It requires engagement and participation and dedication. And then things can take off in unexpected directions.
Well, Professor Chomsky, as always, it's a great honor to have you join us here at Media Matters and to hear your voice and get your counsel. I hope all goes well for you.
Thank you.
And I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board. And I will be back with you in 167 hours. Until then, everyone, have a great week.